a few years ago, I got an email from Darren with an attachment, with a couple of matrices, with entries to about 2,000 decimal places. And he said, help, I don't know what to do with these. And I think they satisfy some relations. But then gradually he came clean and told me what the grand plan was. And, hang on, why am I not getting any response here? So my keyboard is not working, Vanessa. That's working, but the keyboard is not working. So
try that. There we go.
Thank you. Right. Okay. Okay. So you start off with a. Actually, all we need is a group with a small number of generators and relations, but it's nice to think of this as being a closed orientable hyperbolic free manifold. And we're particularly interested in, so there's a census of these manifolds, which, the first census is for cusp manifolds. So these are manifolds that are made by gluing ideal tetrahedra together. And there's a list which goes up to 7 tetrahedra glued together. And actually, I extended this a couple of years ago to 8 tetrahedra, but I'm sure there must be mistakes, so I kind of keep quiet about it. But at any rate, if anybody's interested, I can send them this list of about 12,000 odd cusp manifolds with 8 tetrahedra. That's kind of by the by. And so these manifolds, you make compact manifolds out of them by doing surgery on them, and they have rather small volume, and their fundamental groups have rather simple presentations, so they're kind of tractable for what we want to do with them. So I'm interested in these closed manifolds, and so such a manifold is a quotient of hyperbolic space by a discrete group of isometries, which is essentially just the fundamental group of the manifold. And just to set the scene, there are various models, of course, of hyperbolic space, but the one we want to use here is the Minkowski model, which actually is the model that generalizes best to higher dimensions. And so hyperbolic space is situated inside a four-dimensional Euclidean space, but with the funny metric, the Minkowski metric, which is the one that's used in relativity theory. And so hyperbolic space is a hyperboloid. It's the set of points whose Minkowski inner product with itself is -1. And that hyperboloid actually has 2 sheets, but we just want one of the sheets, so we have the first coordinate being positive. And then the isometries of hyperbolic space, it's just a subgroup of the Lorentz group, it's the subgroup that the direct isometry, so you want determinant 1, and you want that upper sheet of the hyperboloid to be preserved. Okay, so what are these matrices? Well, they're just like orthogonal matrices, but with a slight variation. So just like with orthogonal matrices, if you want the inverse, you transpose, but you then have to change the sign of things in the first row and also in the first column. That's the that's the 3,1 aspect of those. Now that so the fundamental group therefore is represented in a natural way by these matrices, and it's rigid by Mostow rigidity. You can't change those matrices slightly outside their conjugacy class. But the conjecture is that although we can't deform the representation within the within 031, maybe we can deform it if we embed 031 inside a larger group, because then there'd be more space to move around. And down the bottom there, we have some possible candidates for the larger group containing 031. And we could just take 4x4 matrices with determinant 1 and forget about the form. Or we could embed in SO41, you know, just bump up by one dimension, embed just a sort of diagonal embedding, and then see if we can deform the representation. The SO41, we tried with 4,500 manifolds, and we could only get one of them to deform inside SO41. So that's not a good one to play around with. Even the SL4R, which is, so SO41 has got dimension 10 as against 6. Well, deforming things is good because it sort of gives you insight into the shape of things, a sort of general, that's a good question, but, so. Yes, exactly. Right.
So here you have H3 thing inside H4. If you can deform it, then you start deforming that group, and you have the kind of deformation theory analogous to
Yes, I suppose you could say, well, that's just replacing one question by another one, but yes, that's a sort of established line of research. So that's a very good analogy, yes. And so there was one manifold which did deform into SO41, but the deformations were really complicated, and I gave up trying to analyze them. So SL4R has got dimension 15, so you'd really expect to be able to deform into that 15 against 6. But in fact, it's very rare even there. I don't know whether to be surprised by that or not, but Mostow rigidity seems to be really rigid. Even when you embed the group into a much larger group, it still seems to be rigid, almost always. But sometimes you do get deformations, and they're very mysterious. We don't understand them at all. But at least we can work them out. Yes, so the next paragraph says that there is a rather cheap way of getting deformations if there's a totally geodesic embedded separating surface in the manifold. But you can't do that with these manifolds in the sensors because their volumes are too small. They don't have those surfaces in them. So there were 4,500 manifolds we looked at. And so we did a pretty exhaustive analysis of them, and we found that there were 52 that we could deform out of that, so around about 1%. And so how do we manage to do so many? Well, there is a very quick way of ruling out most of them. You linearize the problem. You see, if there is a... So you've got this canonical representation, and you wonder whether it's on some curve or maybe a variety of dimension more than one. Well, if it is, then there's a tangent space at that point. And so you can check to see if there is a tangent space just by doing linear algebra. You have to do some Fox calculus on the group presentation, something like that. And if there's no tangent space, then there can't be, well, it can't at least be the smooth point of a variety. The converse is not true. Sometimes you get the tangent space and you don't get the variety. In fact, that happened with nine manifolds. So the tangent space can't be integrated to give you the variety. So the first one that worked was the third one in the census, which is aptly called Vol3. Because it's the third one. And M00731, that sort of tells you how you make it out of the seventh cusp manifold in the sensus. And its volume is happens to be the same as that of a regular ideal tetrahedron, one point something. And there's its fundamental group. And we want to show that it deforms. So those matrices that Darren sent me in the email were matrices for the generators of that group. And so he sent me these matrices and had to figure out what to do with them. Well, you can work out the characteristic polynomials of those matrices, and of course everything is just approximate, and everything is guesswork. Until right at the end, we actually can check to see whether we've got the right answer, but there's an enormous amount of guesswork which one has to put up with. So it doesn't take very much. So these are to thousands of decimal places, but it doesn't take very much to guess that, you know, this is just some random transcendental number. Well, of course, actually, it's a rational number because it's to maybe 1,000 decimal places, but it's an approximation of some number, sort of fairly arbitrary number. But you can see that these coefficients are approximately minus 1, and it doesn't take much to spot that this is related to that in that way. And but, of course, to get really started, we need to be able to get a representation where V is a rational number. So the way this is done is the initial representation, the canonical one, and then you just perturb it slightly, and so you sort of land up in here somewhere, not a representation. But then the condition for being a representation is a system of equations that you get from the relators of the group. And you can then use Newton's method. I mean, there are two 4x4 matrices, so there are 32 unknowns. And you get lots of equations from the relators. And so you use Newton's method. And Newton's method goes where it wants to and sort of lands up here, maybe. And what you would really like is for this to have a characteristic polynomials, where the coefficients are algebraic numbers. And to begin with, we weren't very good at that, and we just had to be content with the generic point on the curve. But you can still get information because you can work out traces of lots of words, and it turned out that they were very nice. And once you've got enough traces like that, you can actually reconstruct the representation. It's enough to actually work out the matrices. Well, at least up to conjugacy, but you can conjugate so that they're in some kind of canonical form, and so you can actually work them out. And then you can set about trying to you can write a program that will actually work out matrices for any V you like. So that's what we had to do to begin with, but actually we got better at it, and we actually managed to control the Newton's method so that it would converge to anything. So, for instance, if I wanted V to be 2.1, I can put a constraint on the process and I can get it to converge to a representation for any particular V that I want, so long as it's reasonably close to the original one. And so going back here, we had this very nice situation where all these numbers were either V or 1, but of course that's not typical. More complicated manifolds, they might be sort of rather more complicated functions of V, maybe not polynomial, but some kind of algebraic function. And you wouldn't be able to spot that, so you have to use some kind of program to figure that out. And there's this wonderful facility in PARI, which is a famous number theory program, which will guess linear relations between components of a vector. And that example, that's got nothing to do with this talk, but I just to give you an example of what it will do. So You can. So what I did was, I just did this yesterday, I plugged in those numbers, cube root of 2 and square root of 3 to 100 decimal places, and of course they generate a field of degree 6 over the rationals, for which that's an obvious basis, and so we know that that's going to be a linear combination of those, and this doesn't know anything about field theory, but it just has all those numbers, and it immediately figures out that that's the relation between them, sort of instantly. So that we wouldn't be able to do anything without that. That's absolutely essential component of this. And okay, so this is just summarizing what we did. I don't want to go into all the gory details because it's a bit tedious, but once you've got control, once you can generate the representations for any value of the parameter that you want, well, you generate a whole lot of them, I don't know, maybe 100, for equally spaced out or values of the parameter, and then use some kind of polynomial interpolation to actually figure out in general what the matrices are for some general value of the parameter. And it's still guesswork, but you sort of think it's probably right, and you just sort of carry on. So for Vol 3, I'll actually tell you what we got in the end. And what we got in the end was really rather messy and complicated, but there was a simplification. So Vol 3, so I actually got a picture of Vol 3 here. Let's see here. So this is a Dirichlet domain for Vol 3. So you get Vol 3 by taking this polyhedron and gluing sort of opposite faces together appropriately. And why is it changing? Because yes, exactly. Yes. So what's relevant to this is the symmetry group of all three. It's one of these funny groups of order 16 called the semihedral group. Yes. I beg your pardon? Probably not. This is Windows. But if you. Sorry, the. Oh, right. Okay, yes. Ooh. So there's a symmetry of order 4 which has a fixed point set, which is a simple closed curve in the manifold, and. So what I'm going to do is enlarge the fundamental group by I'm going to adjoin. So this induces an automorphism of the fundamental group, and I'm going to adjoin that to the fundamental group to actually get an orbifold group. And so the Dirichlet domain has got. So you take a base point somewhere in the manifold, and then you apply an isometry to that, so it moves it somewhere else, and then you take a you take the set of points equidistant from those two points, and you get a face. And you just do this with you throw away all the part of the manifold on the other side of the. Sorry, this is in. This is actually in hyperbolic space rather than manifold. So you throw away all the stuff on the other side of that bisector, and you do that for all the elements of the fundamental group, and then that's what's left. But the thing is, as you move the base point, the combinatorics of the polyhedron change. So that's why that's changing. It's going round and round that loop. And, okay, so you've seen that now. And, yes. So we got this slightly larger group, but you can see that it's generated by U and A because you see you can get B out of that one. So if I just tell you what the matrices are for U and A, then we have a representation. Well, actually, it was easier to have U and U squared A, which is just as good. So there you are, that's a representation. So if you plug those matrices into those relators, they work. It's still guesswork up to this point, but now this is where something like Mathematica comes in. You tell Mathematica to plug those matrices into the relator and see if you get the identity matrix, and it does it easily for those. It'll actually do it for much more complicated ones. It's quite amazing, actually. So that was the answer for that. So now the next part of the talk. So sometime later, I had this email from Darren saying, you know what, we're getting all these Hermitian forms of type 3, 1 coming in here. What's going on? He said, do you know anything about complex hyperbolic geometry? So I said, no, not really. I said, do you? No. Sometime later, we still really don't know much about it, but we sort of tried to learn enough to have some slight understanding of what was going on. So it turns out that, so we have this curve of representations into SL for R, but then there was another curve of representations into SU31, which seemed rather surprising, but actually this is inevitable. And the reason why, you might think at first there's some algebraic reason why a curve of representations into SL4R implies one into SU31, but it doesn't seem to be algebraic at all. It's more a question of transversality. So, yes, very important fact is that these groups, their intersection of them is precisely where you start off. This is the real hyperbolic representation into here, and you can deform into here or you can deform into there. So why is that? Very briefly. So SL4R is sort of a real part of SL4C. There's an obvious involution on the group SL4C where it's full of four matrices over the complex numbers with determinant 1, where you just take a complex conjugate of the matrix entries, and then the fixed point set of that is precisely SL4R. But there's another involution you can do on SL4C, which is you do whatever it takes to define SU31, which means you, which the fixed point set is SU31. So what is SU31 fixed under? Well, you take the Hermitian transpose and then do this sign change of the first row and the first column, and then that gives you the inverse of the matrix. So then if you invert, you get back where you started. So that's an anti-holomorphic involution on SL4C, where the fixed point set is SU31. So really, SU31 is sort of analogous to SL4R. It's just a different anti-holomorphic involution. Once you've got this family of representations here, you can obviously complexify. You can just treat the parameter as a complex number, and you get a representation to SL4C. You can look at the action of the other anti-holomorphic involution on the tangent space at the initial representation, and you can quickly work out that there are tangent vectors that point into SU31 representations. So that's all I can say. That's why you get these. But it's a general fact. It doesn't matter what the anti-holomorphic involution is. You will always get representations into that group, which is the fixed point set of it. So now let's shift away from free manifolds and go to two-dimensional hyperbolic orbifolds. So these are two spheres with three points. So the orbifold fundamental group is going to be a triangle group. I'm interested in deformations of the canonical representation of triangle groups into isometries of complex hyperbolic space. So this will be dimension two. And so we just need to review what complex hyperbolic space is. I mean, it's not terribly deep or anything, but it's a little bit specialized. So I hope I'm correct in assuming that not everybody is totally familiar with what complex hyperbolic space is. It's very, you might say, okay, complex hyperbolic space is like real hyperbolic space, but you just have complex numbers instead of real numbers. And there's some truth in that, but it's obviously a great oversimplification. So remember, we saw how to construct real hyperbolic space using the Minkowski model, and we took Minkowski space. We were doing it in dimension 4, but n equals 3, but n could be anything. And rather than take it as a hyperboloid, you can take the hyperbolic space as a space of lines which meet that hyperboloid. So this is a so-called projective model. And so it's the set of lines for which the inner product of a point in that line with itself is negative, and that's well defined because this negative property doesn't change if you multiply by a scalar, and that's the metric for the Riemannian metric. That is just tells you the distance between two lines, and you can take the first coordinate without loss of generality to be 1, and then you can just concentrate on these last n coordinates here, and you can see that, so these, if you fix this to be 1, then these ones are going to lie inside an open ball, and you can think of the hyperbolic space as being in an open ball, an open disk of dimension n, and that's the Klein model of hyperbolic space. And then the isometry group, of course, we know what that is. I've sort of written it a bit differently there, but it's actually the same as SO plus N1. And so now to get complex hyperbolic space, we do the same thing, just but with complex numbers and Hermitian form. And instead of orthogonal group, we have a unitary group. The formula for the distance is the same. And again, we can take the first coordinate be 1, and then we can think of hyperbolic space, complex hyperbolic space, as being inside a ball of complex dimension n. So those are complex numbers now. And the group of isometries, there are two kinds of isometries. There are holomorphic ones, and there are anti-holomorphic ones. So that's a new kind of thing that we didn't have before. You see, there is an isometry which is just taking the complex conjugate of all the coordinates. And it's obvious that's an isometry if you look at the formula for distance. But the holomorphic isometries correspond to the group PUN1. So you take the unitary group of that form, and you projectivize, you just factor out by the scalar matrices. So for instance, if it's U21, then those are 3x3 matrices, and you would just factor out by the scalar ones. So that anti-holomorphic isometry I mentioned, where you complex conjugate everything, that's a representative of the other coset. There are two cosets of the holomorphic isometries. So here's some trivia, just to get some vague feeling for what it looks like. So it's reasonably nice. It looks the same everywhere, because the isometry group acts transitively on the tangent bundle. So it doesn't matter where you are in this space, you look in any direction, it always looks the same. But then makes it complicated is that it doesn't have constant sectional curvature. So that causes problems, actually. Well, it makes it very interesting. So, consequence of that is number four, is that it's very deficient in totally geodesic subspaces. So one kind of geodesic subspace is, if you like, it's a CHM, where M is less than or equal to N, and the other sort is where you isometric to there's a very natural totally real subspace where you make all the coordinates real, and that looks just like ordinary real hyperbolic space. And then a totally real subspace is just something that's an image of that under some isometry. So you can see that if n is greater than 1, then you don't get any totally geodesic hyperspaces, something of codimension 1. There aren't any. And so you can't do this Dirichlet domain construction nearly so easily. Remember, we saw that movie of Vol 3. You have bisectors. If you have two points, you can certainly talk about all the points that are equidistant from both, but that's not totally geodesic now. And two of these can meet in a really complicated way. They can have a disconnected intersection, for instance. And there have been papers written where people have tried to construct fundamental domains, and they made mistakes because they didn't appreciate this fact that intersection of these bisectors can be really nasty. And finally, you can do it with the quaternions, and even to a limited extent with the octonions, but that's just, as far as I'm concerned, a curiosity. So what about the PQR triangle group? So we have three generators, and the product of them is the identity, and they're of order P, Q, and R respectively. And we want the sum of the reciprocals to be less than 1. And so over here I've got a picture of... So this is tessellation preserved by the 3-3-4 triangle group. So in fact, in this picture you can take... So the three generators, alpha, beta, and gamma, you can take alpha to be rotation through a third of a turn about the center of this central region. And then beta, that's got to be of order 3-2, so you can take that point up there where the three edges meet and do a rotation counterclockwise through a third of a turn there. And the four, you can take that next one and you can rotate through. And if you compose those, you'll find that you do get the identity. And so that's a good picture of how that group acts. And you can also see from this picture that the limit set is going to be the entire boundary of the hyperbolic plane. So what about deformations? Goldman and Choi had already worked out that what the dimension of this deformation space is. But they worked out its dimension, but didn't sort of work anything out specifically about it, as far as I know. But if P, Q, and R are all greater than 2, then you get 2 dimensions of deformations. So they're going to be 2 parameters for the variety. Oh yes, so these are actually pictures of the parameter spaces, the varieties in parameter space. But I better go on to the next slide just to explain what those are. So the coordinates of this, they're the real and imaginary parts of something to do with traces. So this sort of symmetric expression in traces of words there, and essentially the horizontal axis is just the real part of that, and the vertical axis is the imaginary part. And there's some kind of horizontal shift I put in just to make things a bit nicer, but that's not terribly important. And so if we look at these, so these were drawn by Mathematica, and Mathematica is a bit sort of fickle. You tell it to draw the solution set of something, and it decides which bits it wants to draw and which it doesn't. So so this is certainly not a complete picture. These are not complete pictures, but the canonical real hyperbolic representation is always at the right hand end of the figure. So so for instance, it's there, and these inside here are representations into the isometry group of complex hyperbolic plane, and so are those actually. Where it crosses over and you get another region, so the top diagram just to the left of the origin, there's a sort of triangular region there. So they're not actually complex hyperbolic representations. They're representations into isometries of elliptic space with the Frobenius-Studi metric. And but then when you cross over again and get into those other ones, you get back into complex hyperbolic geometry. And for different values of the parameter, you get sort of vaguely different shapes. I mean, some of them look a bit like fish. We call them fish diagrams. And some of them look a bit like blimps, don't they? But so probably one should try and classify, you know, what values of parameters give you which kinds of diagrams. Never got round to doing that, but should probably do that. Oh yes, so the other thing is that so going back to this, the triangle group actually is generated by rotations, but each generator actually can be got as a product of 2 reflections in edges. And so the question is, can we do that for that? That's rather convenient to think of the group that way. So that's a larger group, which sometimes called the reflection triangle group, and it's nice to wonder whether you can do that with these complex hyperbolic representations also. So the representations that go along the horizontal axis, so yes, you can. The generators can be expressed as products of holomorphic reflections in very much the same way. When you go off the horizontal axis, then you can't actually, but you can do something similar. The other thing is that the generators are still rotations, they're elliptic, so they have fixed points which are inside a complex hyperbolic plane, and one wonders how these 3 points are situated. Triangles in complex hyperbolic geometry are really very complicated. For instance, the convex hull of 3 points in general is not 2-dimensional. And but there is, nonetheless, there is a trigonometry theory which is a bit hairy, but it's not too bad. So when you go along the horizontal axis, those three points are actually in, they're going to be in a CH1, a complex hyperbolic line, which incidentally is isometric to real hyperbolic space, but with a scale somehow. When you go along the edge here, the three points, fixed points, are actually in a real hyperbolic plane, inside the complex hyperbolic plane. So, but then when you're in between, then it's neither one nor the other. So let's see here. That's what I just said there. Okay, so what about when we're in between? They're still products of things, but they're not reflections in the ordinary sense, but they're kind of very similar. So there's a typical ordinary reflection. You just stick a minus one in that spot in the matrix, and that's a special case of where you have some root of unity. Not a root of unity, just a point on the unit circle. It might be a root of unity, in which case that thing will have finite order, but in general it can be just a point on the unit circle. And that's called a complex reflection, with reflection factor eta, and those are the guys that you have to use to form these generators. The generator of the triangle group are products of those things. And so how do I figure that out? Well, there's this interplay between experimentation and actually trying to do things properly, you know, using the theory. And it would have been very difficult to guess without doing the experimentation. So I spent a long time doing the same kind of thing that I did for Vol 3, you know, with the numerical stuff, but with triangle groups were lots of different PQ and R being the orders of the generators, and then gradually acquired some kind of feeling for what was going on, and then after that, you know, confirmed it by deriving it all theoretically. So I can actually tell you what the formulae are. So here's just a little fact about triangles in complex hyperbolic space. It's enough to know the lengths of the sides of the triangle. You need an extra bit of information, and this can be got in various ways, but this is one of the ways in which it can be done. This is quite elegant, something called the brain shape invariant, and that's a formula for it, and so the side lengths together with this guy here actually are enough to specify a triangle up to isometry, up to congruence. So I did all this experimentation and finally landed up with these formulae here, and probably doesn't mean anything, but I mean at least you can see there are formulae. So P, Q, and R, remember, are the orders of the generators, and A, B, and C are the side lengths, and so those are formulae for them, and there's the shape invariant there, and also incidentally there's a formula for the reflection factor, because remember the generators are products of these matrices with complex reflections, and this is actually a point on the unit circle, and so that was it. It did turn out to be quite simple in the end, but it took a long time to figure that out. I don't know. I mean, maybe this was known before. I don't know. I couldn't find it anywhere in the literature. I mean, it's not at all deep, but difficult to, you know, to get the right formulae. So it's So this is the last page of the text. I just I've got a few more movies to show you, but so remember, there's this interplay between deformations into the isometries of complex hyperbolic space and the and just the SL NR. And that first paragraph is telling you how to get from the complex hyperbolic ones to the SL ones, which correspond to real projective structures. So there's this question of discreteness. So it's very nice to know whether a representation is discrete or not, and to begin with, it's certainly discrete. And you sort of go into these away from the real hyperbolic representation, and it's discrete for a while, but then eventually discreteness will fail. Particularly, it will fail when an element which was hyperbolic becomes parabolic, and then after that becomes elliptic, because as soon as you have an elliptic, as soon as you have a rotation to an angle which is an irrational multiple of pi, well, that cannot possibly be discrete, right? And so so discreteness will definitely come to an end, except at maybe at isolated points after that. So going back to these fish pictures, I've got I've actually made some movies about what happens when you take that 3-3-4 one and move along that upper edge. So these are the ones where the three fixed points of the elliptics lie in a real hyperbolic plane. And remember that to begin with, we had this, where the limit set was a circle. It's the boundary of the hyperbolic plane. So when we deform, the limit set, so this is again very analogous to what happens with quasi-Fuchsian deformations. The limit set is still going to be a circle, but it'll be a sort of fractal circle. And then when discreteness fails, then the limit set is not going to be topologically a circle anymore. So let's see if we can get some kind of picture of that. Let's see. So this is the limit set. Now, so the boundary of complex hyperbolic space is three-dimensional. So in order to see these limit sets, you really need to have them moving around so you can get some kind of three-dimensional perception. And, this one's not very exciting. So this is just the original, and you can see, well, it looks like a circle, right? Okay, enough of that one. So, so this is moving on just a little bit. And you can see that it's got a bit kind of jagged looking, but it's still, that's a circle still, right? Sorry? So, I've deformed the real hyperbolic representation, and I'm looking at the limit set. And the limit set is still going to be a circle, but it's not going to be a smooth circle anymore. It's a fractal. And it's getting more and more distorted, and then we'll see what happens finally when we cease to be discrete. I've got a picture when it is actually parabolic, and then it looks pretty amazing. But then after that, it sort of degenerates totally. So, so that's that one. The interesting thing is, and I've not been able to understand this, but you see this more with the later pictures, is that there seems to be a sort of tangent plane in some sort of macro sense for these things. They're sort of locally planar somehow. Not globally, but locally. So let's see what the next one looks like. Yeah, so this is getting a bit more sort of distorted, but you can see that locally it's kind of planar, isn't it? Probably something that would be easy to prove, but I've got no idea how to do it. Let's go to the next one. Yes, well, do you think this is still a circle? Well, yes, I think so. It looks like that, yes, I agree, yes. In fact, that seems to seem to be, well, in the end, I don't think it's a curve, but probably fills up space, yes. that's number three, so... Yeah, so that's getting even worse. But I think that's still a circle. Maybe I'm being a bit optimistic, but... that's getting a little bit suspect, right? I think that's what happens. That's the way when that. So deciding when discreteness stops is a very difficult problem, and I don't think it's been solved for any of these triangle groups in general. It has for some of them where you go along the horizontal line, but for this, nobody knows for any of them where discreteness fails. But certainly you can conjecture that there are very likely elements that seem to be the first ones that become parabolic, and that's probably where it fails. But certainly it's not known for sure. And then finally, this is beyond that point, and yes. I don't think that's a circle. This looks like a swarm of bees. Okay, so I think that's a good place to stop. Thank you. I mean, I just made those pictures just completely mindlessly, just by working out the coordinates and making those animated GIFs. But I haven't thought about that at all. So, but that'd be interesting. Well, all I know is where the fixed points of the. So I haven't really thought about it. I mean, you've got the fixed points of the elliptic, so I know where they are, and so I know what the triangle is, and I know what the reflections are, and the. Oh. Oh, right. Oh, I see, yes. I really don't know. I mean, yes, maybe. There are just so many fascinating questions here, which I am making more questions than answers here. That's for sure. So, But I hope I've conveyed that there's some interesting stuff here that one can think about. No, I mean, getting that orbifold presentation, that for us was just a device for getting some neater matrices. We didn't really think about what it meant geometrically at all.